Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
When we are done gallivanting through the featured book on today's broadcast, there's a really good chance you're going to want to go deeper into the subject of the Bible, where it came from, how it was canonized, who wrote the Gospels, how the books were transcribed and translated and passed down, where did it all come from? History of the Bible, the making of the New Testament canon, is a lecture at the Great Courses Plus that is taught by none other than Dr. Bart Ehrman. He's the author of books like Jesus Interrupted and Forged and How Jesus Became God. Well, Ehrman walks us through the origins and the theorized origins of New Testament books, and he approaches it like a historian, while so many other people have approached it like pastors and apologists. It's really good stuff. The Great Courses Plus has this and over 8,000 other lectures on a huge variety of subjects, from science to languages to health to the arts to economics to travel and hobbies. Stream to any device and learn something new today. I love the Great Courses Plus. I think you'll love it as well. Sign up today with my special URL and get a free month, 30 full days of complete access to the Great Courses Plus library. Check it out, start your free month today, and sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Today is a very special day. Today is an exploration into the most popular, the most widely published, the most distributed book in the history of history. And of course, we're talking about the Christian Bible. But today, we're not going to be telling the most popular stories, the ones we're used to hearing from the pulpit and from our Sunday school teachers and in vacation Bible school and at children's summer camp and in home studies and prayer groups. We're going to be talking about stories from the Bible that are not often told, or at least not often enough. Now, upon the telling of these stories, I am convinced there are many in the listening audience who will say, no, that cannot be in the Bible, or I've never seen that before written in the Bible. They'll be riddled with doubt, wondering if indeed we are teaching from the Bible today. And for that reason, with each story we tell and each lesson we give today, I will include book and chapter and verse so that you can go and read these stories for yourself. Let us explore the Christian Bible, the good book, my friends, so that we might best understand the actions and the attitudes and the will and even the very nature of God Himself. By the way, we're going to finish the broadcast with a guest instructor. I'm not going to tell you who it is yet. It's just somebody I thought would be a nice addition to the show and a great way to sort of cap our lesson today. So, guest instructor near the end of the broadcast, FYI, okay? Our lesson today begins in the book of Genesis. No, it's not the story of creation, of Adam and Eve, or even of Noah and God's genocidal water park. No, this story comes out of Genesis chapter 12, and it starts with a guy named Abram. Now, Abram is actually a foundational character in Scripture. He's a common patriarch for the three Abrahamic religions. In Judaism, he's the founding father of the covenant between God and God's chosen people, the Jews. In Christianity, Abram is a prototypical foundation for all believers to follow. In Islam, he's part of a chain of prophets that starts with Adam. And yes, Adam is a prophet in Islam. And it ends with the prophet Muhammad. Now, God actually changed Abram's name to Abraham, which is a name you're probably more familiar with. That happened in Genesis chapter 17. God promised him he would have a multitude of descendants, even though Abram was about 100 years old. So Abram, the noble father, became Abraham, the father of many. 100 years old, and the guy's sex life was just getting started. Gives hope to the rest of us. But let's go back to Genesis 12, when Abram was still a spry 75. And he set out on a journey to the land of Canaan with his wife Sarai. Not Sarah, not yet. Sarai, S-A-R-A-I. Also in tow was his nephew Lot and an entourage of other people. They carried all their possessions with them and they traveled. And Abram was given a promise that one day his offspring, his descendants, were going to inherit the land. And so Abram built an altar there. He built another altar east of the city of Ai, because apparently you can never have enough altars, right? You're going to stop somewhere, you know, it's like a rest stop. You take a break, build an altar, move on to the next destination. Abram set out again. He traveled and he journeyed, and he ended up just outside the city of Egypt. But there was a problem. Abram's wife was hot, and I mean gorgeous, beautiful, I mean blazing hot, smoking. And you got to remember that women at this time were pretty much, you know, property. So somebody might kill you to steal your wallet or your donkey or your hot wife, right? This is a problem. So Abram came up with a solution that is not in any way bizarre or creepy. He said, "Hey, Sarai, why don't you pretend not to be my wife? Why don't you pretend to be my sister? And this way, all those horny Egyptian dudes won't kill me and then abscond with you. But instead, they'll treat me really well because they're going to be trying to be all gentlemanly and impressive." Essentially, Abram was saying, if you're my sister, they can stare at your ass while I cover mine. And this was indeed a wise plan, because when Abram and Sarai did ultimately go into the city of Egypt, the Egyptians were entranced by her. They were captivated by her beauty. Genesis 12:14 says, quote, "The Egyptians saw that Sarai was a very beautiful woman, including the people who worked for Pharaoh," right? Pharaoh's staff caught a look at her and said, "Dude, you got to see this woman." And Pharaoh indeed was impressed. You see, he invited the couple over and he saw her beauty, and he actually rewarded Abram. He rewarded Abram for her beauty, which is weird, isn't it? "Hey, you got a really pretty sister. So here, let me give you some free stuff. Here's some sheep and cattle and donkeys and camels and a pile of servants, both male and female." He essentially rewarded the man because the woman was attractive. That's what happened. Now, verse 15 said that she was, quote, "taken into his palace." Verse 17 said, "God then inflicted Pharaoh and his household with serious diseases." Now, it doesn't go into a lot of detail here. In fact, it just says serious diseases. We're not totally sure what those were. Some have said it was the plague. But if he took her into his palace, it's very possible, in fact, it appears quite likely, that the diseases were STDs. Because Pharaoh said, quote, "Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." And Abram took Sarai and all their newly acquired loot, and they left. Now, what are the lessons of this story from Genesis chapter 12? Well, Ultimately, God wants men to be able to save their own skins by breaking the ninth commandment about not bearing false witness when they lie about their own marriage. That's an important one, kids. And then you can fill your own pockets by throwing your wife at powerful men for the purposes of that man's sexual fulfillment and pleasure. Ultimately, justice will be done when you are showered with a bunch of earthly possessions that God later says to shun because material possessions are fleeting and unsatisfying, and what's important is the heart. And also, when God gives the strange men who were porking your wife syphilis or genital warts or the clap, which means your wife probably also has it, and then if you have relations with her, you get it. Wait a minute, I'm not sure what the moral of the story is. I mean, God's seventh commandment in the book of Exodus forbids adultery. Adultery is defined as voluntary sexual intercourse between a married person and someone who's not their spouse. Well, this is kind of what happened, right, with Abram's wife. He said, hey, she's my sister, take her. And she ends up in Pharaoh's bed. Pharaoh at one point even calls her his wife. Now, does this count as adultery? And is Abram to blame or is the wife, right? Abram voluntarily offered his disguised spouse to Pharaoh. So he sort of facilitated the whole thing. But does that count? Because, you know, 1 Corinthians 11:9 says that women were created to submit to men and their authority. So he essentially is pulling the puppet strings. And she didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. She was submitting. So is she on the hook? Did she actually sleep with Pharaoh? Like, do we know that? The Bible doesn't say. Did they consummate the marriage, which wasn't a valid marriage because she was already married to Abram? What if she had become pregnant? Well, kids, you know that God created a special test to help us determine these kinds of things. Let us move to the book of Numbers, chapter 5, starting with verse 11. The Lord told Moses to tell the Israelites about this little fidelity test for married couples. Essentially, you're the husband, and you suspect your wife has been sleeping around with another guy. But there aren't any witnesses. You can't find any actual evidence. You just suspect it. You just think, it's happening. I just know it in my bones. It just feels wrong. And you become jealous, really jealous and suspicious about the whole thing. Well, in Numbers chapter 5, verse 15, you are told you can take your wife to the priest along with a specific offering of grain and other ingredients. I mean, the Lord's very specific about the kind of food he wants you to bring for some reason. And the priest will essentially help you determine. The priest has the woman take a standing position inside the tabernacle. So she's right there standing front and center. And then he mixes up some floor dust. He actually pulls dust off the tabernacle floor and he mixes it into a jar of holy water. It's in a clay jar. And he goes over and he, for some reason, loosens the woman's hair and he makes her hold the grain offering in her hands. And then he forces her to drink the liquid, the stuff he just concocted with the tabernacle dust from the floor and the holy water. It becomes a bitter liquid. Verse 18 calls it bitter water that brings a curse. And the accused wife is required to agree to all this. Well, now the priest does some other incidental ritualistic stuff, but ultimately the woman is forced to drink the bitter water that brings a curse. Now, the good news is, if she's not an adulteress, if she hasn't been, you know, sleeping around, nothing is going to happen to her. But if she has been sleeping around, verse 27, she will feel, quote, bitter suffering, and the water will enter her, and, quote, her abdomen will swell, and her womb will miscarry, and she will become a curse. Essentially, God will abort the fetus. Which apparently is just fine for God to do because he's God, and Christianity will, in this case, remain completely and totally unconcerned about the rights of the unborn and their definitions of personhood and all that. Just remember, though, that throughout the Bible, from the drowning of pre-born babies in the great flood, Noah's flood, to the poisoning of mothers' wombs to make miscarriages happen on purpose, to the execution of pregnant women by Moses' army in Numbers 31, to threatening to rip open the wombs of pregnant mothers as punishment in Hosea 13:16, it was Yahweh himself, God himself, who was the world's very first abortion doctor. Our next lesson jumps from the Old Testament into the New Testament to the book of Matthew. It's a lesson that God can produce riches and glory from any orifice He so chooses. Allow me, my friends, to elaborate. Matthew chapter 17. Jesus and the disciples arrived in Capernaum, but apparently it was tax time. Tax collectors were out and about, walking around, and they were apparently unimpressed with the whole Jesus and his disciples thing. Right? We don't tax Jesus because he's a God thing. They were not impressed. And so, the temple tax collectors approached Peter and they said, "Hey, why doesn't your teacher and mentor ante up like everybody else? Doesn't he pay the temple tax?" And Peter responded, "Well, of course he pays it." I'm guessing because he didn't know what else to say. And then he went inside the house where Jesus was, and he told him the story. He said, "There's a couple of tax guys out here, and they're asking for their money." Jesus then declared that he and the disciples were tax exempt. Remember that Jesus, or God, owns the cattle on a thousand hills. It actually is God's money to begin with, but to help keep the peace and not come off as all offensive to the tax collectors, Jesus procured a 4-drachma coin. Now, did he pull it out of his pocket? No. Did he conjure the coin from the air? No. Did he borrow it from a disciple or somebody else? No. What he did was this. He told Peter, "Walk out to the nearby lake and go fishing. And then when the first fish takes the bait, then you reel that fish in, pry its mouth open, and voila, a coin for the exact amount required will be found in its mouth." Now, some have speculated that this particular fish is surpassed only by the Babel fish as the oddest thing in the universe. It's Matthew chapter 17. What do you do when God Himself tells you to prepare a meal using your own excrement? You've heard the expression that someone made really shitty food? It happened. But perhaps we can learn something from the story out of Ezekiel chapter 1. God is speaking to Ezekiel. God wanted to memorialize the siege of Jerusalem. And so he instructed his servant, Ezekiel. He said, "Construct a model of the entire city. And essentially, I want you to kind of reenact the siege. You know, like you're playing army men," which seems like a perfectly sensible use of Ezekiel's time. Ezekiel 4 starts with verse 1. It says this, and I quote, "Now, son of man, take a block of clay, put it in front of you, and draw the city of Jerusalem on it. Then lay siege to it. Erect siege works against it, build a ramp up to it, set up camps against it, and put battering rams around it." He's literally playing army with Jerusalem. "Then take an iron pan, place it as an iron wall between you and the city, and turn your face toward it. It will be under siege, and you shall besiege it. This will be a sign to the people of Israel." Can you imagine the people of Israel watching a guy using all these little sort of action figures? I mean, that's what he's doing. And he's like, "Oh, yeah, we're commemorating Jerusalem. We're telling a story. I'm sending a message." It's difficult, I think, as well, to envision this particular scenario without Ezekiel integrating battle noises. You know, if you play army men, you got to do the sounds. "Oh, no, Jerusalem's under siege. Dun, dun, dun. Oh, no, they're rushing up the ramp to the gate. Dum, 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 dum. Oh, no, they're pounding the gate with the battering ram. The city is under siege." This is how I picture this, okay? Did Ezekiel do that? I don't know. The verses don't say. But for my part, I do think the reenacting of a famous battle with models and action figures and not doing the sound effects would be totally unsatisfying. I'm just saying. Verse 4 has the voice of God appearing to Ezekiel yet again. "For you see, his work was not yet complete, my friends. God said to Ezekiel, 'Now, I want you to lie down on your left side and stay there. You're just going to lie there. You will act as a carrier for the sins of the people of Israel. You will bear their sins as you lie there on your left side for the exact number of days, as is the number of years of their sin. Don't worry, Ezekiel. We're only talking about 390 days. About a year and a month, you shall lie there on your left side, not the right side. On the left side, no turning or flipping or shaking out the arm and the leg to get the blood flowing. No cheating on this one. You have to lie there for 390 days. Now, when you're done, if you haven't yet died from any number of health complications that would arise from lying dormant on one side for over a year, you then must flip over and you must lie on your right side to bear the sins of the people of Judah. Now, there's some good news here. They've only been sinful for 40 years. So using our years today's formula, the good news is you only have to lie on the right side for about a month and 10 days. So you're off the hook there, right? God was pretty serious about this little exercise. He was so serious, he pulled out physical restraints. Ezekiel 4:8 says, quote, I will tie you up with ropes so that you cannot turn from one side to the other until you have finished the days of your siege. And again, this seems like a hugely productive and sensible use of Ezekiel's time. But, you know, it's not like he had a choice anyway. He was going to be tied up by God. Now, as God is not a complete asshole, he realized that Ezekiel's basic needs would still have to be met during this long vigil. And so God had Ezekiel jam a whole bunch of ingredients like wheat and barley and beans and lentils and other stuff into a storage jar so he could make bread for himself. To bake the bread, he was supposed to bake this bread in the sight of the people so that everyone could see. And as Ezekiel did not have the benefit of, say, charcoal briquettes, God commanded him, and I am paraphrasing here, my friends. God said, the fire you cook with must be fueled by your own shit. You must pinch a loaf and use it to cook a loaf. Because I want the people of Israel to eat defiled food. That's a paraphrase, but it's pretty close, and you could look it up in Ezekiel chapter 4. Okay. Well, Ezekiel had been just fine with the idea of being tied up and propped up on one side for over a year. But the whole cooking with your own poo thing was apparently crossing the line. And so he finally protested. Ezekiel 4:14. Ezekiel said, not so, sovereign Lord. I have never defiled myself. So God said, okay, fine. I'll let you bake your bread over cow dung instead of human excrement. And Ezekiel seemed just fine with that. And so he was bound and tied and generally left immobile to rest on his side while God cut off Jerusalem's food supply and basically starved the population. The Lord is good, but he is also just. An inspiring Old Testament story which raises the interesting question, is human poop flammable? Like, I know flatulence is flammable. Certain excrement can be used for fuel, I know. I'm not really sure the science of it. It's not something I think about when starting a campfire cookout. Well, fortunately, in the age of the internet, you can Google pretty much anything. Apparently, not only is our poo a viable fuel for the flames, you can also use it to do other stuff. There are indigestible fibers in poo that you can use to make paper. You can use it for camouflage. There's certain guano they use that makes gunpowder. And poo emissions can also be transformed into natural gas, which makes it a handy, if odorous, energy alternative. Ah, the Bible is filled with nuggets of wisdom. That one out of Ezekiel chapter 4. Still, it's hard to imagine that Yahweh would allow such stink into his presence. After all, God himself produced a list of desirable and undesirable things that he does and does not allow in his presence. Specifically, we go to Leviticus chapter 21. God's talking to Moses. While we normally see God as the accepting, loving, you know, come as you are kind of God, the deity that sees past the petty and the physical and the temporary, and he focuses on the heart and the mind and the soul, that God, he does seem to come across as extremely particular when allowing people to have access to his temples. I mean, how many times have we heard pastors assure us that we could simply come to God, approach God as we are, and he would accept us? In Leviticus 21, not so much. Verse 18 kicks us off. No man who has any defect may come near. No man who is blind or lame, disfigured or deformed. No man with a crippled foot or hand, or who is a hunchback or a dwarf, or has any eye defect, or who has festering or running sores, or damaged testicles. Yes, my friends, God in his presence wants intact and healthy balls. I mean, how could one defile the house of God by showing up with an impaired pear? With sickly stones, with polluted plums, diseased danglies, wacky nads. Who could commit such an affront to the Almighty? Who could be so, if I may, ballsy? It shall not be allowed, saith the Lord, to pray and praise in the presence of thine perfect and powerful paranormal parent. Thou must procure a pristine and perfect pair. Leviticus 21, trust me, it's in there. Yahweh has always had a weird thing about male genitalia. I'm reminded of the inspiring and hugely educational Bible story from 1 Samuel chapter 18, the story of David, his bride-to-be, and a specific wedding dowry that you would never be able to register for at Bloomingdale's. Here's the story. Samuel anointed Saul as the first king of Israel, but Saul turned out to be kind of a disappointment, which is weird, considering that God was behind the appointment of Saul, and God has the knowledge of all things, past, present, and future, and of course the content and character of men's hearts, God knows that. It seems like God could have skipped the whole Saul thing and gone directly to his next choice, David. But the Lord works in mysterious ways, and we shall not be so arrogant as to question his methods. Now, David defeated the enemies of Israel. David defeated Goliath. David was the man. He was a hero. All the towns of Israel were saying, hey, sure, Saul, King Saul has been a powerful badass who has killed thousands of people in God's name. But look over here at David, who has killed tens of thousands of people. And as we measure one's goodness by how many men, women, and children they chop into little pieces, we think this David guy is really impressive. Well, Saul heard all these cheers for David, and he was not happy. Saul was jealous, and he was a bit scared about David's growing popularity. This cannot be good, right? What happens if David wins the next popularity contest and I'm shown the door? 1 Samuel 18:10 is a bit confusing. It tells us that Saul was overcome by an evil spirit, and that caused him to try to kill David. He threw a spear at David in an attempt to, and this is a quote, pin David to the wall. And the verse also tells us that the evil spirit, which prompted Saul to commit murder or attempted murder, that evil spirit came from God himself. Did God want to make Saul a murderer? And if God wanted Saul to succeed, why didn't he improve Saul's aim, which was so bad as to totally miss David twice? And if God foreknew that David would fall in love with Saul's daughter Michal and would ask for her hand in marriage, didn't he realize how tense all of this might make family gatherings at the holidays, right? We simply cannot know. Again, the Lord works in mysterious ways. But David and Michal were to be married. And there was another daughter in the story, but she was committed to somebody else. She didn't love David. There's three verses right in the middle of this chapter that are as useless to the story as they can be, which I'm sure is why Samuel included them in God's perfect book. But back to the action. King Saul, unsuccessful as an assassin, he decided he would try another tactic. He decided to get rid of David through an elaborate, sort of a Dr. Evil kind of scheme. He would send David off to battle the Philistine army, partly because Saul wanted a specific price, a specific wedding dowry for his daughter's hand in marriage. It wasn't silver, wasn't gold, wasn't land or property. It wasn't allegiance or loyalty. Saul wanted, for his daughter's hand in marriage, Saul wanted fleshy penis parts. 1 Samuel 18:25 says, "The king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies." Now, why Saul wanted foreskins as a wedding dowry is not really clear, right? If he's looking for trophies from battle, there's a lot easier ways to go. Fingers or toes or eyes or scalps or swords, or he'll take a Polaroid of the war zone, you know, the piles of the Philistine dead. Right, we simply don't know. We do know that Saul asked for penis bits in the name of his daughter, and this was not in the slightest bit weird. Saul's secret agenda, his secret goal behind all this, was not a big bag of pecker pieces. Okay. Saul was hoping that the deadly Philistine army would kill David for him, send David off into a dangerous battle, and eventually David is going to fall in battle. He will die, problem solved. And then nobody would be the wiser that Saul was behind it. But alas, David was victorious, and he returned from battle not with 100 foreskins. No, no. David brought back 200 foreskins. And we know this because Saul's attendants actually counted them. One foreskin, two foreskins, three, four, five, a dozen, 50, all the way to 200. They counted the foreskins. How were these procured? How were they transported? How were they delivered and stored? This is not clear. The Bible doesn't offer up those particular details, but think of yourself, what would you do with 200 fleshy, penile presents procured from Philistine pokers? David used those foreskins to gain favor with King Saul, and to the king's daughter he was promptly wed. Bloomingdale's, eat your heart out. As David and his band of merry men slaughtered the Philistines, let's move to the book of Judges for yet another story about death by sword. Kind of. It's the story of King Eglon of Moab. This is in Judges chapter 3. God was angry with the Israelites. Again. In fact, God seems to spend a whole lot of his spare time just being angry at the Israelites, which is weird, because they're acting in ways that God knew about long before there even was an Israel. But maybe God was one of those guys who just felt anger was a good motivator. You know, just set it up, let it happen. This is how you get things done. Anyway, God was angry. So God allowed King Eglon, along with the Ammonites and the Amalekites, to eventually attack Israel and take over. And King Eglon ran the show over there for about 18 years, almost two decades he was in charge, Israel under his boot. But the Israelites, as they often do, realized they had been wrong and they repented. They'd seen they'd acted in evil ways, they screwed up, and they cried out unto God and they said, "Please send us a deliverer." And so God gave them a hero named Ehud, E-H-U-D, quote, a left-handed man. That's right out of scripture, which apparently was so notable as to warrant mention in the scripture. A left-handed man came to save the day, and the Israelites came up with a plan. They would tool up their new champion, Ehud, with a double-edged sword that was about one cubit long. That's about a foot and a half to the rest of us, okay? It's not a very long sword. How effective could it be? Aha! You're getting ahead of me. Just keep your pants on till we get to that part, okay? Because it's coming. Now, the Israelites sent Ehud into the presence of King Eglon, carrying a tribute for the king. And while the king was receiving the gift, Ehud would say, "Hey, king, while I'm here, I have a secret message for you." And that's exactly what Ehud did. The king emptied the chamber so that the two could talk privately. Verse 20 and 21 says, quote, "Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper rooms of his palace and said, 'I have a message from God for you.' As the king rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly." Now, you think this might be the end of the story, but you would be wrong. Because apparently, King Eglon was big, obese, like morbidly obese, and his body essentially ate the sword. Oh, you don't believe me. Verse 22, quote, "Even the handle sank in after the blade, and his bowels discharged. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it." Well, this was awkward, because he wasn't going to get his sword back. The assassin Ehud went outside to the porch, and he locked the upper room doors behind him. And the king's servants became curious. "Hey, why are our master's doors locked?" But Ehud was ready with an excuse. He told the servants, and again, I'm paraphrasing. He told the servants, "Hey, the king is inside taking a dump." And so while the servants waited outside as Ehud quietly slipped away, the servants sat outside the door going, is he okay in there? I mean, how long do we wait? Did you knock? I knocked a second ago. He's sure taking a while. King, you all right in there? King, you need anything? Everything all right? No answer. And finally, the servants decided something must be wrong, and they busted through the doors. And what did they discover but their king dead on the floor? And Ehud got away, and he blew a trumpet, and an Israelite army killed about 10,000 Moabites. Verse 30 says, "That day Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. That's all the chapter says. Like, did the servants realize that there was a sword inside the dead king? Did they bury him with the sword inside the body? If they cremated him, of course they would have discovered the sword. Here's a popular story from the New Testament. I know it's familiar to many people, but I thought it warranted mention here. I have sort of reformatted it for the 21st century audience. It is the story of the cursed fig tree, drawn from what I am now calling the Newer American Literal and Not Metaphor version of the New Testament. Mark chapter 11 says that Jesus was leaving the town of Bethany. Jesus was hungry. After all, he was God, but he was also a man with physical needs. Jesus was hungry, and he approached a barren fig tree which bore no fruit for him to eat, and he became disgruntled. He became agitated, even angry. Jesus was angry with a tree. And Jesus said to the tree in Mark chapter 11, verse 14, Jesus said, "Where's the damn figs?" And his disciples heard him say it. Now, I realize it might seem a bit odd for someone who created the universe to not be able to create lunch, but I strongly encourage you to move on with the story. Jesus looks at the tree and says, "You're barren." And in verse 21, upon the next morning, Peter was shocked and amazed to discover that the cursed fig tree had wilted. Now that's strange because of the verses in Matthew chapter 21, verse 19, which says that Jesus got all up in the tree's face and then, quote, "immediately the tree withered." So Mark tells us that the disciples discovered that the tree was withered the following morning, but Matthew says it happened right there, right then, in front of their eyes. But what can we learn from this story? We can learn that God knows everything. Psalm 147 tells us, quote, "His understanding has no limit." No limit except, perhaps, knowing when figs are in season. Back to the Old Testament, my friends. The story of Moses has long been the stuff of legend. But when we watch things like the Cecil B. DeMille film classic from 1955, The Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston playing Moses, why did they exclude what could arguably be described as one of the most interesting parts of the Moses story? They just totally left it out of the film. In fact, they left it out of every incarnation of the Moses story I have ever seen. Well, no longer, my friends. Of course, we must delve here into the book of Exodus. God had just finished training Moses on how to do magic tricks. These are tricks he would need to impress Pharaoh. You know, the staff turning into the snake, the hand becoming leprous and then being healed again, the turning of river water into blood, those types of things. And eventually, Moses then headed off to Egypt to perform the Lord's wondrous deeds so that the captive Israelites could be freed. Now, of course, given Exodus chapter 4, verse 21, where God said, I will harden his heart, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so that he will not let the people go, the whole freedom plan seemed pretty unlikely to succeed. And to the human insect, to our pithy minds, it probably makes no sense that God would seek the rescue of the Israelites while hardening Pharaoh's heart so that he would not free the Israelites. But let's move on. That's not the interesting part of the story. The interesting part is the part that we don't see displayed on the stage or big screen. The interesting part of the story comes in Exodus chapter 4, verse 24. Quote, at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. Now, at no place in this story are we told why God would send Moses on a mission of rescue after all this time and training, all this instruction, and then suddenly decide to punch his ticket. There's no clue as to why he was going to do it, but apparently he did something to piss God off. Fortunately, Moses' wife jumped in, and she saved the day. Her name was Zipporah, which, if I may, sounds like a Pokemon character. Zipporah, and her special Pokemon power, was apparently the understanding of how to appease an angry Old Testament God. And so with that knowledge, Zipporah went to work. She took a flint knife and, verse 25, quote, cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it. Well, of course. I mean, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't think to do that? And Zipporah said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. And the Lord looked down at the fleshy foreskin on Moses' feet, and his anger was assuaged. Now, it's at this point in our storytelling exercise when you might be wondering, and I'll just answer the question outright. As throughout Scripture, foreskins were cut and taken and given and received and gifted and brandished and offered and paid, there is a good reason to suspect that penis skin was actually a form of Old Testament currency. You know, you go to the store, you go to market, hey, that'll be 15 foreskins, and here's your change. I mean, that's highly likely, I think. Jesus told us in Matthew chapter 5 that we should not return violence with violence, that we should not stoop to the level of an evil person. We should take the high ground. We should freely give whatever physical price our antagonists wish to extract from us. Verse 39 in Matthew 5. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, and I'm guessing Jesus is talking about the face, turn to them the other cheek also. Verse 40. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. Turn the other cheek. We've so often heard God commands us to be agents of peace in the midst of a physical threat. But let us, my friends, drift backward, chronologically and morally, to the book of 2 Kings chapter 2, where God's prophet Elisha was on his way to Bethel and definitely did not turn the other cheek. You see, a group of small boys came out of the city and they saw Elisha, a prophet that was so holy that he had only recently received what the Bible calls a double portion of spirit, which hang on, isn't what you think. Now, Elijah was another servant of God who rode that fiery chariot off to heaven. You probably heard the biblical story of Elijah. He was so holy, he was so obedient, he was so profound and powerful as an agent of God's goodness here on earth. He didn't even die. He actually rode a fiery chariot and rendezvoused with God in heaven. But Elisha, not to be confused with Elijah, Elisha said, "Hey, before you go, would you endow to me, would you give to me a portion of your spirit?" Apparently, each servant of God has a specific portion. Think of it as like a measuring cup of God's spirit. Like some people have a teaspoon of God's spirit. Other people might have a cup, two cups, a pint, a quart, a gallon of God's spirit. Well, whatever Elisha had, he said, "Would you give me yours?" And he doubled the amount of God's spirit within him. Now, Elisha's on the road. And he's just outside of the city of Bethel, and these antagonistic young boys walk out and start to make fun of him. This is not wise. If you're kind of a snotty, bratty, rude, arrogant child or group of children who comes out of a city and sees a doubly spirited prophet of God who happens to be bald, a helpful safety tip would be for you to not make fun of that man. Right? He's already all keyed up. He just received a double helping of spirit. He's definitely feeling his oats. But alas, these youths did not hold their tongues, and they sealed their own fate. 2 Kings 2:23, as they jeered, "Get out of here, Baldy. Get out of here, Baldy." And apparently they thought they were pretty funny. Until Elisha turned around and he called down a magical curse from on high. And right there, two bears, some translations of the Bible go as far as to say she bears, which is apparently an even greater threat. But two bears appeared out of nowhere, pretty much, and they tore 42 children into quivering bloody hamburger. I know, right? I mean, after all, language is violence. Or at least some people say language is violence. It was hate speech. The kids had it coming. It was a proportional response. Obviously, it makes sense morally. Now, for some credible commentary on this story, we go to the website Answers in Genesis, which addresses the concerns of good people that Elisha's response and God's response involving the violent murder of children might have been a bit much. It might have been a bit harsh, a tad disproportionate to the circumstance. And there's an article by Dr. Elizabeth Mitchell, who is, wait for it, an obstetrician. And she, in the article, clears your conscience right up when she writes this, quote, "They were old enough to know better, and they were challenging the credibility of God's prophet, the only man who was there to stand up for God's truth." That's right, kids. The death of children by a ravenous, righteous bear. What more proof do we need to know for certain that God is just? And that sometimes, on some appropriate occasions, the other cheek might belong to the child that you just dismembered. Coming up next, for those who feel that at this point in our Sunday school lesson, there hasn't been nearly enough murder, I've got some good stuff planned for you after the break. And again, at the end of the show, a special guest instructor will bring you a lesson from the pages of God's Word. It's more of Seth Andrews Teaches Sunday School right after this. Hang on.
Wonder working power. So much blood of
the land there is power. Angry, jealous, angry power in the precious blood of the Lamb. Thank you so much to my patrons for supporting this broadcast. Don't forget, if you support me on Patreon, you get a commercial-free version of the broadcast and a bonus show every month. You can just log on to patreon.com/SethAndrews. Today is a broadcast called Seth Andrews Teaches Sunday School. Again, these stories are drawn directly from the pages of the Christian Bible. Our next Sunday school lesson today is the story of Jephthah. I love this story. It's so inspiring. And it shows such obedience to God. I mean, unquestioning obedience to Yahweh when you make a promise and he insists that you keep that promise. Here's the story. Jephthah was a mighty warrior. His father was Gilead. Jephthah's mom was not Gilead's wife. His mom was, well, a prostitute. And Jephthah ended up living in the land of Tob, T-O-B. Now, he had fled to Tob because his brothers were ostracizing him because he had a hooker for a mom. Like, the brothers came from the womb of Gilead's actual wife. And they saw Jephthah and thought, this guy's kind of a counterfeit, right? He doesn't deserve any family inheritance or family standing. He's not a real son and he's not our real brother. And so Jephthah moved off to Tob to essentially feel resentful about the whole thing. But the elders of the town of Gilead ultimately decided that they needed Jephthah's help. You see, they were at war against the Ammonites. It was the Israelites versus the Ammonites. And Jephthah was a badass soldier. I mean, he was a great and mighty warrior. He was a fantastic leader of men. He was an asset that they needed. They needed his skill and leadership on the battlefield. And so the elders sought him out and they promised him that they would make him head over all who lived in Gilead if he would just come back and help the Israelites to be victorious over the Ammonites. Well, Jephthah took the deal. And then he decided to sort of stack the deck in his own favor and he asked God for some help. Judges chapter 11 verse 30 tells us, "And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering." Now, it's at this point, kids, when we have to stop and think about the kinds of things that might come out of the door of your house to greet you. It wouldn't have been an inanimate object because, you know, those things are inanimate. Was Jephthah expecting perhaps an animal sacrifice? Well, it's possible. You know, he trained the family dog to jiggle the door handle and let himself out into the front yard whenever he heard his master approaching. That's possible. But beyond that, it is a little strange that Jephthah would be surprised that the offering to be, you know, the whatever that was to come out of the door of his house to greet him would be anything other than a person, you know, a member of the family living inside the house. But that's what happened. Jephthah made his promise. He was victorious in battle. He devastated 20 whole towns. And when he came home, his only daughter, heard him approaching, and she happily bounced out the front door to say hi to Daddy. Now, if I may paraphrase, verse 35 of Judges chapter 11. When Jephthah saw his daughter come out of the house to greet him, he said, "Oh, shit!" And he declared that he was devastated. That's the word used in the story in the Bible. That's a quote. Devastated. He tore at his clothes, and he wailed, and he cried. Now, at this point, it is a wonder that Yahweh didn't simply punish Jephthah, just kill Jephthah for being so unbelievably thick as to make this kind of promise. You know, I'm sorry, you're just lowering the collective IQ of humanity. You're taking up oxygen. We should just off you instead. But he didn't. Yahweh did not kill Jephthah or punish him in any way. And the daughter did the noble thing. She looked at her dad, verse 36, and she said, "Dad, you have given God your word. You made a promise. And so do with me whatever you promised to do, and I'm okay with that. Just let me do this. Let me go off and wander in the hills for 2 months so that I can cry about it with my friends, seeing how I'm not ever going to have the chance to get married. Now, apparently she's unconcerned about being burned alive, but she is pretty upset that she's never going to have a husband. Welcome to the Old Testament, where God does like his sacrifices to be sexually pure. And so off she went into the hills, and she cried for 8 weeks, which had to have been exhausting. And then she returned, and Jephthah made her a burnt offering, an offering of an innocent girl writhing and screaming in unimaginable pain, an offering which God accepted without protest, without pause, because, you know, a promise is a promise. Now, some declare that burnt offering isn't meant to be taken literally. When the Bible says burnt offering, it doesn't mean burnt offering. You know, just like the words slavery and kill and dash your infants against the rocks and hate your family in Jesus' name and everlasting fire and those types of things. Those aren't to be taken literally. Some say Jephthah's daughter was merely consecrated to God, meaning she had become kind of a celibate bride for Yahweh's service here on earth. She had promised to never take a husband, to be sexually pure, and just connect herself in every way to God. Now, why that would make Jephthah scream and cry and tear at his own flesh and announce that he was devastated with surprise and heartbreak, the apologists have yet to properly explain. Our next Bible story is about a mixed-race couple. Now, again, I know that we're always told that God doesn't really care about the color of your skin or where you were born. He only cares about the heart. But it's hard to reconcile that against this story. Maybe you can find the moral that I could not. Moses and the assembly of Israel, they were sitting at the tent of meeting, and they were all crying and weeping. They were all sad. They were weeping because Israel had screwed up again. The people of Israel had started having sex with Moabites, which apparently was very bad, and they started worshiping Baal and generally stoking God's anger and wrath against them. So God ordered the transgressors to be executed, or at least their leaders. This is Numbers chapter 25, verse 4. The Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of these people, kill them, and expose them in broad daylight before the Lord." Essentially, Yahweh was doing what ISIS does, right? Execute people and then display the bodies in public to scare other people and make a point. But he's Yahweh, so this is perfectly moral. This is just and righteous and excusable and acceptable and even good, okay? Verse 6 tells us that the trouble was not yet over, though, because an Israelite man brought into the camp, he brought a Midianite woman. Now, it's not clear why this was a problem, seeing how God would soon allow Moses' armies to exterminate Midianite men and the non-virgin women. Those people were to be killed, but they could kidnap the virgin women to be their sex slaves. That happened just a few chapters later, Numbers chapter 31. A Midianite woman can apparently, you know, be worth having in the right context, but not in this context, it would seem. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, saw this, and he got up from the meeting, and he went and he got a spear, and he followed the couple to the tent that they were in, and he skewered them with the spear. Now, he was able to get them both with a single spearing, right? Went through the guy, and it says it went into her stomach. So it would seem that the couple was probably already going hard at it. Now, did God punish Phinehas for executing two human beings, for shish kebabbing a consenting couple who happened to be of mixed race and background? No, God actually favored Phinehas, stopping God's plague against the Israelites, declaring that Phinehas had caused him to turn his anger away from the Israelites, and to Israel, a covenant of peace was then granted. Apparently, all this happening while the dead couple was still back in the tent, pinned to the bed or the wall or wherever they happen to be in Congress at the moment of penetration. Now, immediately after this covenant of peace was granted with the Israelites, what did God do? God went to Moses, and God said, "Now that we have peace upon Israel, I would like you to declare war. War upon the Midianites." But for me, that's not the point of the story. The point is that God, in certain contexts, is the God of racial purity. No interbreeding between the races. No Israelite-Midianite congress or relations or relationship. The two cannot intermix, interrelate, certainly interbreed. Racial purity. Next time you see somebody in a contemporary headline talking about the separation of the races and that it's God's idea, they might just be drawing their conclusion from the verses of the Christian Bible. Our next story has a death, not by sword or by fire or by flood or by lightning from the sky, not by plague or famine or a visiting angel of death. Our next story features an admittedly exciting and novel death by tent peg. Let us, my friends, return to the book of Judges, this time in chapter 4. Now, this is one chapter after the story of Ehud, which we told just a few minutes ago. Remember, he was the assassin, and his sword got swallowed up by the king's belly fat. Well, by the very first verse of the next chapter, Judges chapter 4, the Israelites, who'd been in hot water before, had already forgotten what happens when you displease God. And so they'd gone off again and rebelled again and done evil deeds again. And God was pissed off at them again. And so God punished them again. This time he sold the Israelites over to the king of Canaan. And the king's military commander, Sisera, had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for about 20 years. And again, as is their pattern, they finally cried out to God for rescue. "Please send us help, send us a hero." And God again did so. Ultimately, war was declared on the oppressive Canaanites. And the Canaanites eventually found themselves losing the war, and the evil commander Sisera ran away. Apparently, he was not all that brave. And he ran and he hid in a tent of an ally, a guy named Heber the Kenite. Heber, by the way, sounds like a candy bar to me. Like, are you hungry? Try a Heber. I don't know why that just sounds funny. Now, Heber apparently wasn't around, but his wife was there at the tent, and she greeted Commander Sisera. And she said, hey, this is verse 18. She says, quote, "Come, my lord, come right in, don't be afraid. Essentially, get in the tent, you'll be safe here." And Commander Sisera entered the tent, and she covered him up with a nice warm blanket. Now, we should not let her generous welcome of the commander fool us. For the wife, and her name was Jael, she was apparently not a big fan of Sisera. And she was also apparently a major player in Yahweh's victory plan against the Canaanites. Verse 19, Commander Sisera said, "I'm thirsty." And so Jael opened a skin of milk, and she gave him that to drink. Verse 20, Sisera said, "Alert me if you see anybody come by asking where I am." And she said, "Nobody's there." Verse 21, Sisera finally fell asleep inside the tent. And while he was out cold, just sleeping away, resting right there in the tent, Jael went over, and she picked up a tent peg and a hammer, and she walked over to the guy, and she placed the tent peg against his skull and then hammered it. And I mean, not just through his head, but all the way through and into the ground below. Verse 21 reveals to us the obvious result when it said, quote, "And he died." Well, Jael's husband finally showed up at the tent and said, "Hey, where's Sisera?" And Jael said, "Come here and let me show you." And she brought him into the tent where he saw the guy pegged to the ground with a tent stake. Now, Judges chapter 4 doesn't tell us what the conversation was beyond that. We're told in verses 23 and 24 that God's army destroyed the Canaanite army and their king that very day. And the death of Canaan's commander certainly played into that victory. It was an important strategic step, right? But what does a husband say to his wife when he discovers what she's capable of when a man she does not like goes to sleep? Now, it's quite possible he simply smiled nervously and he said, hey, can I help you with the body? And then he made a mental note to never piss this woman off ever. By the way, if Heber and Sisera were allies, wouldn't he have been angry? The Bible makes no reference to him being angry or disappointed or shocked or afraid or any of those things. He just walked in and just saw this guy pinned to the floor. It's amazing the things the Bible chooses to include and to exclude in the telling of these important lessons. Speaking of proactive women, you probably wouldn't want to be one if you were trying to break up a fight between your husband and another man. Let's go to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 25, verses 11 and 12. Just two verses cover this command. We've all seen what happens when a couple of guys get angry at each other and they get all up in each other's face over some kind of disagreement. Maybe they're fighting over money, or territory, or a woman, or their favorite sports team, or whatever. Politics, you just never know. They get angry with each other, and they eventually come to blows. Fists start flying, and there's definitely no turning of the other cheek. Well, the Bible tells us that the woman was created to serve and help the man. She is a help mate. 1 Corinthians 11:9 again, right? Well, she had better not try to help the man in a specific way. And let me clarify. Let's say the two guys are fighting and the woman rushes into the thick of the fight in an attempt to assist her husband. And she decides to help neutralize the opponent by reaching over and grabbing his... She grabs his... How do I say this? His wedding tackle. His baby maker, his baloney pony, his private parts, all right, his twig and his berries. She reaches over and grabs him by the groin area. Now, this would be, according to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 25, verses 11 and 12, a direct violation of God's law. God saw fit to issue a specific edict against this very thing. And if the woman does reach over and grab the guy by the nads, the men are to stop fighting. So they can then carry out violence upon the woman. No kidding. They are to take the woman, and whatever hand touched his private parts, they should summarily chop it off at the wrist. Deuteronomy 25:12 says, "You shall cut off her hand, show her no pity." You know, maybe if she'd thought to toss some foreskins on one of their shoes, she might have been all right. My final lesson before I hand things over to my guest instructor and the final Bible lesson of the day. This one comes from Numbers chapter 11. This is a reminder to all of us that we should remain thankful for what we have, thankful for what we are given, and we should stop whining about what we are not given. Moses had led over 600,000 Israelites out of Egypt, and they were doing that long, long, long 40-year journey to the promised land. Now, this is a journey that should have taken them just over a week and a half. But God was always in various stages of irritability and anger with the Israelites. So essentially, he just kind of let them bang around aimlessly in the Arabian desert for almost half a century, okay? Well, what did these people eat while they were wandering in the desert? The Bible teaches us that they ate manna. Manna was an edible substance that God made to fall from the sky, kind of like snow. Hence the popular phrase, manna from heaven. Manna is described in Exodus 16 as a flaky food that had to be collected every night before the sun came up and melted it. So it was perishable and apparently pretty fragile. It went bad after just one day, except on the Sabbath, when God would give it some extra magical preservatives, because you're not allowed to work or gather on the Sabbath, so he extended its shelf life, so to speak. It was described in Scripture to be like a white coriander seed. It could be prepared in various ways. You could grind it up, you could make cakes with it, you could eat it like a wafer. But it was, admittedly, a pretty bland and boring food. I mean, imagine, every day for 40 years, and the Israelites began to notice this. Numbers chapter 11, verse 4 has the people complaining, quote, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. This kind of complaining in the face of Yahweh is a very bad idea, right? Bitching to God about the food that he magically manifests and causes to fall from heaven after he has rescued you from captivity in Egypt, this is not a wise move. And so when Moses went to God and said, "Look, the people are driving me crazy. They're asking for meat all the time. Even if I wanted to go out and procure meat, to go out and try to slaughter animals, there's no way I could handle this burden. There's way too many people. I'm just one man. I can't handle it. I'm overwhelmed." And God did what God so often did throughout the Old Testament. He decided to make the Israelites pay. He told Moses, "Tell the people," and now I'm paraphrasing verses 18 through 20, "Tell the people, fine. They want meat, they're going to get meat. You just tell them to get ready." And so Moses went off to calm the people and tell them, "Relax, folks, God's about to change the menu." So the people were apparently happy with that news and they went to sleep. And that night, instead of manna falling from heaven, God drove quail in from the sea and essentially stacked the quail all around the camp. I mean, to the point where the people couldn't see past the quail. The Bible says that quail littered the land for a full day's walk. And so the people woke up and saw all these quail all around them. And essentially, they kind of had to eat their way out. So they gathered the quail, and they gathered more quail, and they gathered even more quail, and they ate the quail. And they ate more quail, and they stuffed themselves with quail. God had been serious in Numbers 11 when he declared the people would eat for a month, quote, "until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it." That's a direct quote from Scripture. And while they still had meat stuck in their teeth, verse 33 of Numbers chapter 11, meat was stuck in their teeth, God sent down a plague that killed the people who'd been complaining. Essentially, "Screw you, you little ingrates. I'm God." That was the message. And so they buried their dead and they renamed the place Kibroth Hattaavah. And this translates "the graves of craving." Now, what's the lesson here? Some would say the lesson is be thankful for what you have. I personally think that the lesson is something else. I think the lesson is this: if you were born an Israelite in the Old Testament, you should probably go ahead and just off yourself, because you have a pretty short life expectancy on God's watch anyway. To cap the broadcast today, I've asked a friend and fellow infidel, Eli Bosnick. Eli Bosnick is a New York comedian. He's one of the hosts of God Awful Movies. His sense of humor seemed perfectly suited to this particular style of show. And I asked him to put together a final lesson for our listeners drawn from the pages of the Christian Bible. And so, my friends, I thank you so much for listening to this point, and I hand the podium over to Eli Bosnick as we continue an exploration into God's perfect word.
Hi there, I'm Eli Bosnick from The Scathing Atheist, and when you're dealing with a trip as heavy as Revelations, you need some crazy people. So Seth called in the only podcast he knows that's anywhere close to as weird as what John is about to tell us in Revelations. So, for context, this dude John has just been kicked out of Greece for being crazy, and when the book starts, he's obviously found a nice field of mushrooms covered in opium, because this is what he sees. He's sitting there, wondering if that shepherd sold him the fake stuff, when all of a sudden he sees a guy with long white hair and glowing feet who looks an awful lot like Jesus, surrounded by lampshades. Like, he just went on a spending spree at Pier 1 Imports or something, I don't know. And he knows it is Jesus with one tiny difference. See, he's got a sword sticking out of his mouth. Yeah, a sword, kids. What's going on here? How did it get there? Never mind. Because now Jesus is going to yell at seven churches. with a sword in his mouth. This is a weird talent show. Moving on. I'm going to save you some time. The letters are basically go to the bathroom in the toilet and really double down on hating the Jews. That's the message. Saved you 50 pages. Because at this point, like J.K. Rowling writing Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, Jesus gets tired of trying, and either he or John or he and John see a giant floating door in the sky and go through it. Well, Jesus goes through it and John's like, oh man, that was short. And Jesus is like, no, you come too. So he floats up through the door as well. Take that, Woodstock. Y'all ain't got nothing on the Bible. And who should be behind that door? But God. Which is nice, you know, to welcome him. But he's made out of stones. Gemstones that don't exist. Still think Hobby Lobby's a joke? Yeah. Boom. Joke's on you. And with him are 24 advisors. Why does God need advisors? I couldn't tell you, honestly. He's like that friend in college who read Think and Grow Rich, and now he calls you every time he wants to break up with a girlfriend. But no, not just them. There's also, okay, bear with me, eyeball monsters? See, one's a lion, one's an ox, one's an eagle, and one has the face of a man. Which doesn't really tell you what that last one is, to be fair, but face of a man. And these are monsters covered in internal eyeballs. And you're probably wondering, kids, what does that look like? Sorry, you're just gonna have to ask the Bronze Age dude who found the naturally occurring pool of LSD and took a swim in it who wrote this. Anyways, these eyeball monsters, they're not just hanging out, watching Knocked Up, playing PlayStation. Nope, they're singing. Singing about how great God is. At which point God notices John and Jesus, and he's like, hey, you guys are the guests that show up 30 minutes early to the party. And I just want you to know, nobody's ever going to break these seven seals. Which really bums John out, but apparently it's all part of God's punked reboot, and he lets John know that Jesus is in fact going to break them. Which seems odd. Like a use of time and page space, but there were just singing eyeball monsters, so I guess backsies shouldn't be that far out of the possibility. So Jesus, anyways, with the white hair, soul in his mouth, gets to open and seals, and the first one is a guy on a white horse with a bow. And I hope he didn't run into anyone with a machine gun, because he's out killing. Guy number two, he's on a red horse, he takes away all the peace. All of it. Horseman 3, I think he's an accountant, he has scales, he hands out pay stubs, something about barley, very confusing. And then, alright, bear with me, finally, whoever was writing this realized, oh, we're all out of horses, so there's the pale horse. Now, to be fair, in the Bible, he's the pale green horse, which is very clearly just a green horse, way less menacing, so the Christians call him the pale horse. Anyways, he gets all the powers, death, pestilence, making your Shih Tzu attack you. Those bites can be worse than you think about it. And at this point, they open a bunch more seals, and some of them turn out to be empty, like bad loot chests in Destiny, just like, oh, really? Another pistol? Thanks, Bungie. I'll put this right here in the garbage. Anyway, it's time for trumpets. And these trumpets, they make stars fall to the earth, they put the sun out, all sorts of bad stuff, which, you know, granted, physically impossible, but we did just have eyeball monsters, so bear with me. What are you gonna do? Also, this summons the scorpion, lady-faced lion... Wow, there are scorpion, lady-faced lion body crown-wearing monsters that attack people. I feel like I should have read through this before I... Okay, so the star that fell to Earth, the first one, he's alive. His name's Abandon. He starts walking around, bumming people out the way they do. Then, alright, I'm back on track. A river in Iraq dries up. I feel like that's less of a big deal. Now, okay. See, then there's an army of 200 million soldiers. They kill a third of the Earth's population. Weird choice, gonna be honest, to follow the river with that. Seems like it would be overshadowed. I personally wouldn't even notice. Okay. You know what, kids? I just realized we're not even at the sun-faced, fire-leg, thunder-voiced angel. We're not even on chapter 10. So I'm gonna turn you back over to Seth. We're going to take a quick nap. I'm going to take a quick nap. But yeah, drugs and religion. Not even once, kids. Not even once.
Here I go.
Thanks for listening to the broadcast today. This was a lot of fun to put together. And to anybody, again, who is skeptical that these stories exist in the pages of Scripture, it's all right there, chapter and verse. You can go and look it up for yourself. I hope your week is wonderful. I'll see you next time. You know, instead of the show outro, I kind of like this music. It reminds me of Excalibur, you know, the classic John Borman film. I'll just play it out. And I'll see you next time on the Thinking Atheist radio broadcast. Take it easy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.